Welcome to another episode of Mino's World, and this week I have another special guest with me, and I say special because this is the first time I've had a guest come back on the show. This is episode 54 with Jaspreet Kaur, and Jaspreet came on the episode, on the podcast, right at the very start when I just started off and I only had a few followers and probably just a few lessons. Arabica is putting in her two cents as well, as she usually does. I'm sorry if there's any background noise because I've given Radhika a toy and I'm sure she's going to bash it around on the computer as I try to do this intro as smoothly as possible. But when I first interviewed Jaspreet, she had just signed a book. So today, on this episode, we talk about the process of writing during a global pandemic, which was particularly challenging, and to see how far she's come and to see, well, how far I've come as well. Never gone back to speaking to a guest right from the very start, so it's a nice time for both of us to reflect. You can order Jaspreet's book if you go to her website browngirllikeme.com, and you can follow her on social media as well to find snippets of her book and to find out more about why this book means a lot. Yes, Radhika, it's a book. Radhika, say book. Radhika, say book. Good girl. And to see why this book is so important for South Asian women and why it's important to amplify the voices of South Asian women in the space of writing. So before Radhika ruins my intro, I'll let you get right into the show. Welcome to the show, Jaspreet. It's so nice to have you back again. I've never said that to any guest before.
I am back. Thank you for having me back. I'm so excited.
I remember you came on probably the first couple of episodes. I believe it was probably episode 2 or 3 that you joined me. And that was a time where, I mean, I only had like 20 Twitter followers and just a couple of hundred.
Like worlds away. This was like pre-pandemic, pre-baby, a lot of things. It's like so much has changed in that time.
I say that quite a lot to my guests. I don't actually remember that time. I feel like it's been completely clouded because I've changed so much over the last couple of years. My life has changed so much that I don't even remember the kind of person I was, you know, my belief systems, my values, everything's just changed so drastically that I don't remember that person I was, but I'm still very grateful that you supported me at that time as well.
Of course. And even if it feels like you're a very different person back then, I feel that way. Absolutely. Like if I look at who I was 10 years ago, if I look at myself 5 years ago, even a year ago, of course, we all progress, we change, so much about us develops and moves forward. But I feel there were still parts of who you were then that have continued in you now. Even for you to start the podcast back then must have meant there was something in you that wanted to create this space, that wanted to do this work, even if it has changed a lot since then. So yeah, it's still in you, even if you don't remember it in that way, maybe.
That's an interesting food for thought, Jaspreet. I've never really thought about that, like specific time of podcasting, because when I started podcasting in 2016, I listened back to my episodes then, and honestly, I just cringed so much. I was like, I had no idea about anything. I honestly just feel like I was given a toy, which is a microphone, and I just babbled and I just spoke.
New toy. I'm going to talk into it.
It's a bit like what Radhika does when she grabs a new toy. Like she just gets really excited and I felt that's what happened to me as well. And I think it's good to look back, obviously, to see how far you've come. Yeah. But I can only listen a bit at a time before I just really cringe and I just really hate myself. You came on that episode almost... was it about 2 years ago, maybe a bit more than that? And you were talking about the fact that you just got your deal to publish a book.
Yeah, how crazy. Oh my God. And now
and you would have never imagined you would have written it during a lockdown.
Yeah, that's why it's so crazy to think about. It was a different world then. Like this was pre-pandemic. The book had just got signed, or we were trying to get it signed. It was around that time. And then obviously in March 2020, the whole world turned upside down, and I did not expect to write this book during a worldwide pandemic. And don't get me wrong, I've been working on this book for about 6-7 years, the ideas, kind of putting some of the thoughts of the chapters together. I'd started the interviews about 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago, starting some of the interviews for the book. But I had always imagined that when I was writing this book, I'd be going to libraries, I'd be going to coffee shops, kind of this very romantic writer's idea of maybe being in the countryside somewhere. And it obviously didn't happen that way. And I think when we last spoke, I was just about to start my residency post, my research fellow post at Birkbeck. So I had just been offered this post as an associate research fellow with the politics department at Birkbeck University. So it meant that I would have had an office at the university, and I'd literally just went and got my ID badge and seen my office. And I was about to like decide like what posters I wanted up on the walls and everything. And I was about to move into this very fancy office in the middle of central London and would have been next to all the libraries, all the museums, all the archives I would have needed. But then of course the pandemic happened, and we then had to figure out at home how I was gonna write this book from home. Like many people obviously at the start of the pandemic, trying to figure out what was this working from home lifestyle gonna look like. So it was a matter of setting up a desk in the corner of our bedroom, the family competing for Wi-Fi, BG cooking downstairs, like the eclectic sounds of an Asian household, and had all those things going on whilst I wrote this book. And then all the interviews then had to happen digitally. So over Zoom, over calls, and I had to move into that space. So it was an interesting transition from what I thought the book was going to be like in terms of writing it. However, kind of looking back on it and kind of with the benefit of hindsight, I'm kind of glad that did happen, because in a way I'm glad I wrote this book in the home, because the home, as I've mentioned in the book, is one of the most complex places that a brown woman has to navigate. A lot of kind of difficult things that we have to navigate in the home, but also it's a haven, it's also our safe place too. So I'm kind of glad in the end I did write it at home. Maybe a book for brown women wasn't meant to be in a fancy writer's retreat or a fancy office in London. Maybe it was meant to happen in the home. So in a way, I'm a big believer that everything happens for a reason. And I think for this book, this was meant to be from home.
How was the writing process? Because your expectations and the reality had a massive gap, of course. And I remember when we got in touch at the very beginning of the pandemic, you were telling me you're going through all your research, and I saw some photos that you put up about you had papers all over the floor trying to figure out how to put everything in order. Everyone has their own way of writing books, and everyone has their own process. But did you have a process in mind, or did you just sort of go with the flow? Or I mean, what was it like?
Yeah, so my research process was, I guess, a combination of, as a writer, there is my academic side. So there is my academic lens that I apply to writing. So that would mean coming up with a hypothesis, coming up with ideas, thoroughly researching, looking into books, journals. If it was going to have an interview process, which the book did, thinking about my research sample. So that's all that side of the writing, which people will definitely recognize in the book. And all the nerds out there will definitely appreciate all the research that went into this book. That's definitely come from my academic background as a historian, and then went on to do a master's in gender studies. So I have the background in kind of historical study and studying historiography, and then also a sense of kind of sociological work of kind of researching society and thinking about research samples and demographics and making sure that this book was inclusive as possible. So there is a sense of that part of my research process. Then there's definitely the poet in me, and that's the poet in me is definitely thinking about how do I want to convey this message in the most beautiful way possible. And sometimes it isn't beautiful, sometimes it's very messy, but the poet in me was definitely thinking about how did I want to convey that in this book. Considering it was a non-fiction book and not a collection of poetry, it still has snippets of my poetry in the book. Each chapter opens with a poem. So I wanted to think about how I wanted to weave that into the book. And then the final part of it is, how did I want to weave in the other side of me as a writer that is very passionate about stories, about storytelling? Because I think there's a real value in storytelling. And if I kind of look back at all the writers that I admire and really look up to, they've always seemed to weave in storytelling with academic and political writing. And if I could think about people kind of like Malcolm X or Audre Lorde or Arundhati Roy, they do an excellent job of weaving in stories with academic research and those things together, because I heard this really great quote from a TED talk recently where this woman said that stories are data with a soul. And I really love that. I'm totally gonna steal that quote. Stories are data with a soul. Because often when we're sharing stories, and this happens a lot for Asian women, especially in the work that we do, we're sharing our experiences, sharing our stories, and everyone kind of sees them as, okay, that's just Asian women complaining about their lives again. But what they don't realize is these stories really can be used as data, and that data can then be used to make some form of social change, political change, cultural change. So that was kind of how I figured out my writing process. How do I weave all those three aspects in? And then the actual day by day would look like a combination of sitting there researching, conducting interviews, then taking the time to sit and write these chapters, and then editing and proofreading, which is kind of the process that most writers would go through. But there were days of writer's block. There were days of, okay, nothing is coming. There were days of I'd write paragraphs and the next day would laugh at myself. What the hell was I thinking? This is complete rubbish. There would be days like that as well. And I put a few things in place that really helped me when those days happened, because obviously with this book being such a heavy book for South Asian women and for myself, writing about mental health, body image, the family, love, culture, all these things that I was unpacking, quite a lot of stuff that I had sometimes buried kind of deep inside of me, things that I'd maybe not thought about in a very long time. So it was quite triggering at times. It was resurfacing a lot of emotions that I found quite difficult. So when I realized that, I was like, okay, there's a couple of things I'm going to need to put into place day by day that I make sure I do. And that was a combination of making sure I go for a walk every day. So I'm really grateful. We've got a big doggy, Hida. He's a big Spanish Mastiff that we have to take for a walk at least twice a day. So he'd get me out for a good walk every morning. Meditating, trying to make time to see friends and family. But of course, this was all during the pandemic as well. So kind of navigating all those stresses of the pandemic life. But getting outdoors definitely helped me, and that would help me in those times where there was no words coming. But yeah, that was a bit of my process, and I guess it kind of conveys a little bit of who I am as a writer, all these different aspects of who I am as a writer. But some days were hard, and I think that's something that everybody who writes can definitely appreciate, that not every day is a day there sitting at your computer typing away. There will be days there with an empty screen or empty page and nothing comes. And figuring out what things do you need to put in place to kind of spark that inspiration and get those words flowing.
One of the things that I love about your book, Just Read, is that it's not just a guidebook for South Asian women, but it's got your fingerprint on it. It's very generalized, but it's also very unique as well at the same time. So when I read your book, I remember sending you a message, and I read the first few chapters and I said, Just Read, this book is so good. I'm going to finish it by tomorrow, because I knew I had to read it. I knew that it was going to give me that comfort that I needed during a time where we'd been through a pandemic. I just had a baby. I felt completely alone. I felt that everything I'd been through was only something I'd gone through. And then here's Just Breed telling me about her life. And I'm like, well, maybe I'm not the only one who's gone through this. And I have to say, you know, you say that there are some of the emotions that resurface while you were writing, and the same thing happened to me while I was reading it. And that in a positive way, because it allowed me to reflect on my own past and the kind of future I want to have, not just for me, but for Radhika as well. When you were going through your research and your writing, and you're going back to your past as a child, did you have to go back to family members and say, look, this is what actually happened in the past? Because when I was reading through your work, I felt like I had to do that and speak to my parents and actually close that chapter of my life, because I felt it's always been open and I've never had a chance to look back at it and just sort of put a lid on it and just move on. Did you have to do that? Did you have to sort of go through your own therapy and speak to family members and say, look, this is what happened before, you know, I want to talk about it?
Wow. Just hearing that reflection from you is really, really big for me. I'm not going to lie. Just hearing that alone is, one of the biggest things I hoped for from this book, that it will open up conversations that perhaps we've buried away. Because one of the main aims of this book, the nucleus of this book, is a sense of healing, that I want our generation of South Asian women, future generations of South Asian women, and those that have gone before to really feel a sense of healing in this book. And sometimes that will mean having these uncomfortable conversations with family members, things we've buried up inside of us for so long, trying to work through them and navigate them. So there were moments of that for this book, specifically for the mental health chapter, that first chapter of the book. I'm unlayering a lot of the experiences that I had as a child, as a teenager, also in my adult life. And there were conversations I had to have with my parents specifically. And I mentioned in that first chapter that when I was about to do my TED talk a couple years ago, on how poetry saved my life, and it was looking at how I'd been using creative expression as a form of therapy for a very long time. Before I did that TED talk in front of an audience of 1,200 strangers, I thought it was about time that I spoke to my parents, because of course it was going to go online, it was going to go to a global audience in the digital world. So was I really going to be honest with the people that I hold closest to me? And that is my family and my close friends. And I remember I had a conversation with my parents about the fact that I suffer from anxiety, that I'd had these anxiety attacks for a very long time. I'd gone through spouts of depression. And obviously they weren't oblivious to it. They'd witnessed some of these things firsthand. They'd seen when I'd have anxiety attacks, but they never knew how to deal with it. And for them to know how to navigate, that was very difficult as well. But when we had that conversation, there was a lot of questions, but there was no judgment, there was no stigma. And I think we'd really come to a point in our lives where we could have that conversation. And then they went away, and I could tell, especially for my mom, she went away and she thought about it for a little while, kind of needed to process a lot of things. She then came back with a few other questions. But it was so healing, not only for myself, but also for my family as a whole, because I think since then, and since I've been open about my mental health journey, I realized that so many other family members have too. And that's not only just immediate family, but also my extended family. They obviously see what I do and the work that I do online. They've also been a lot more open about their mental health and when they're struggling, and then when they need support, and leaning on family members and leaning on community when they need that support. So I'm really glad I did open up that box, and it was scary. And I know for a lot of women, this is going to be a very, I guess, sometimes opening up wounds again. I think that's definitely how some women have described it, especially the start of that book. It's opening up a lot of wounds, but by the end of it, hopefully they feel this sense of healing, and hopefully they feel this sense of empowerment. And also what you started off by saying, Meenal, that they don't feel alone anymore. And I think for so many of us Asian women, that loneliness that I know I had kind of sitting in the pit of my stomach for a very long time, that am I just alone in this? Is there no one else going through these things? Because I felt like it was just me. But hopefully from this book, a lot of women and girls will see, okay, I'm not alone in this. There is a community out there to support me. And hopefully this book is a little bit of that support too.
Your book gave me a lot of confidence as well, Dispreet, to speak up, because you spoke a lot about your life and your past and your family, and it will help a lot of people for a fact. And to see you write that book gave me a lot of inner strength to say, actually, if just we can share her story with other people, and if it's helping her through her healing, then surely I can even just talk to my husband, right? Before I was even afraid to even talk to my husband about how I felt, and to my parents and my close family. And I've started to realize over the last few months that I do have a sort of background feeling of lingering anxiety that's just there. And I think it's probably since I've become a mother as well, because you're always on this hyper alert mode that, is a baby okay? Is she going to trip? Is she going to fall? Is she going to hit her head? Anything that happens, if she has a trip or if she has a small scratch, you're never going to forgive yourself for it, because you should have been there, and you should have been there for your baby. And there's always this lingering anxiety in my head thinking, am I good enough? Am I the mother I wanted to be? Am I going to break this cycle of generational trauma? Am I going to be able to start a completely new chapter with Radhika? And there's so many things went through my head. every single day just by looking at her face. I just look at a little cute face and I'm like, I just want to do everything I can for you. And it's hard. It's really hard. But you have to put, as you said, you've got to put things in place to deal with it. And having this anxiety is not necessarily a bad thing, because ultimately it is part of your growth. It is part of character building. It is part of creating generational change, which is something we all want to do. But even last night, I said to my husband before I went to bed, I said, look, Nishan, I'm feeling, not feeling great. I've got this like feeling in the pit of my stomach, and these are the things that are going through my head. Let's just talk about it. I know you don't have a solution, but I'm just letting you know. And I woke up feeling so much better, that I wasn't hiding anything from him. I wasn't hiding anything from my family. And even this morning, I saw my mom and she woke up and could tell something wasn't right. And I sort of had to argue with her just to get out of her system. I was like, just get it out. Just tell me what's bothering you. And then we can enjoy the rest of the day, you know. But we've been so conditioned to just bottle it in, just get on with our life. And especially as women and as mothers of the house, you just care, just get on with it. Just feed your child, feed your family, clean the house, next day, same thing. And it's so hard to break that cycle. It's so hard, especially being that person to break it is even more difficult, because it does feel like a big responsibility. Your book is a big step towards that. What else do you think that we can do as individuals to try and not just break this cycle, but also identify issues that are happening around us?
There's a lot of tips and bits of advice in the book about what we can be doing on an individual level. And I guess from the mental health perspective, there's so much we can be doing on an individual level of figuring out what works for you in the sense of what gives you the sense of healing, because for everybody, it's going to be completely different. But one of the connective strands is that we no longer should be bottling this in. And that's exactly something that you just highlighted, even from that conversation with your mum, about bottling in is what's causing us a lot of this trauma and a lot of this pain. And that intergenerational trauma is something that's been passed on from our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation, because of the amount of trauma that they perhaps went through, but never spoke to anybody about it, because especially for their generations. And if I'm thinking about the migrant generations that perhaps had to move over to the UK, post-partition, they had to set up a foundation for people like ourselves and second and third generation kids. So they didn't have the opportunity or even the time to sit and talk about how they felt. So I think we are now the generation to not only figure that out on an individual level about how we're doing that for ourselves, but maybe on an intergenerational level about how we can do that for our parents and grandparents too. So for me as an individual, what I mentioned in the book is that I found a lot of healing in poetry. I found a lot of healing in writing. That was one of my outlets. That was the way of not bottling in a lot of what I had inside, alongside other forms of more formal mental health support. So whether that was counseling, talking therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, and looking out for some of that wider support that's out there. So that's what we can be doing on an individual level, about what works for you and figuring out what it is. For some people, it's music. Some people, it's dance. For some people, it's working out, it's exercise. There will be something out there that really helps you feel like you're not holding all of this stress and anxiety in. But also finding more formal forms of support. And that's something I'm highlighting in that chapter as well, about the changes that need to happen in the mental health services, specifically about being a bit more culturally sensitive, because right now the structures of mental health services that are still very Eurocentric, still catered for the white man or the white woman, may not know how to navigate these things for South Asian people or South Asian women specifically. So looking for more kind of culturally sensitive mental health support that's out there. And there's a lot of amazing resources out there now and networks out there. The South Asian Therapist Directory, groups like Baraki, they're looking at specifically how do we make sure that it's more culturally sensitive to help us navigate the things that specifically as Asian women that we're going through. So that's one side of it. But throughout the book and in each chapter, that then goes on to looking at education, body image, body health, menstruation, love. In each chapter, I've spoke about what we can be doing collectively as a community, but what we can also be doing on an individual level. For example, in the education chapter, going beyond the classroom, one of the significant things I've mentioned in that chapter of what we can be doing on an individual level is a bit more of this self-education. Because sadly, we still have a national curriculum and an education system that might not be providing all the information that we need, especially when it may come to our history, our identity, also our health and body autonomy. So sometimes it's about doing the self-education and looking for the resources out there to do that self-learning. And that's something we can do as individuals. So as you go through the book, go through each chapter, and you'll see that I've provided individual things that we can be doing on a day-to-day basis, but also collectively as a community, shifts that we can be making and changes that we can be making, or things that we can be developing that already exist. So that was something I was quite conscious of when I was writing it, because I want it, we are calling it a toolkit, we're calling it a guidebook, we're calling it a manifesto, we're calling it all these things, but it really, I really wanted it to have the advice that people needed, and things that not only helped me, but helped many of the other brown women that we saw in the book.
Jaspreet, you talk about healing and, you know, trying to move on from this past that you had, where you were always, you know, feeling that you were the different one in the classroom, the different one in society. How do you feel now as a brown woman? Because obviously people are going to see you now and think, oh, she's very confident. She's got a book. She's probably going to come out to write more books, which I know you will. And you come across well-spoken, and in people's eyes, you've got it all figured out. But I remember in our previous episode, about 2 years ago, you did mention that, you know, you had anxiety and depression, and poetry was your form of therapy. Do these feelings still come back to you, even at this stage in your life where you've achieved what you wanted to achieve? You've achieved this book, which is a huge, huge milestone in your career and in your personal life. But I'm asking, has that solved the problem, or is it still something that you're dealing with?
Oh, really good question. This is a really, really good question, because I
oh, thank you, Jaspreet. It justifies everything I do then.
No, I love it. I love when I get questions that really make me think. Because I feel like the work is just beginning. And I know that externally people will see, okay, I've published this book, a big personal achievement, a big professional achievement. People may perceive me as quite confident in the public sphere in terms of the work that I do, but this is all just an ongoing process. And I feel that I'm still working on things. And I feel we will be throughout our lives. There isn't going to be a moment where I feel like my depression has completely gone and switched off and it's never going to come back again. There may be moments where it spouts back. I haven't completely battled anxiety away. There are still days where my anxiety comes back and I have moments of panic. But the biggest shift from where I was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, is I've learned what tools I can put in place to help me in those moments. So I think that's one of the biggest things that I've wanted to show people, is that there are days that I still feel vulnerable. There are days I still feel fragile. And I put a post up only a couple of days ago where I was having a pretty rough week. I was feeling really run down physically. A lot of anxieties were surfacing in terms of things that were going on. And I just needed to take a day out. And I canceled all my calls, all my meetings. I was meant to be meeting up with friends, but I just cleared my calendar for the day because I just wanted to spend a day of having a nap, watching some Netflix, eating some junk food, and just taking a day just for myself, because there are days that I still feel fragile. And as a feminist and all those sorts of things, in terms of what I'm doing externally, sometimes people might perceive that I don't have moments like that, but I still do. There are days I feel really fragile and vulnerable, and I want to convey those moments too, so people don't falsely assume that I'm a strong, fierce feminist every single day, because that's not realistic, and it's an ongoing process of development. And in terms of the book, when people are asking, oh, do you feel like you've really accomplished things now? You've ticked the big box that you wanted to tick. I feel like my work is just beginning. I feel like this book is a collection of all the experiences and knowledge and messages that I wanted to convey from kind of the last decade of my life. But now going forward, it's thinking about, okay, all this knowledge that I've packed into this book, how can I make sure it's reaching as many people as possible? And that doesn't mean selling as many books as possible, but also thinking about how can I make this education within the book as accessible as possible, in different mediums, in different forms, in creative ways, in digital ways. How can I share this knowledge as far and wide as possible? Because maybe not everyone's going to read this book, but how can I make this message reach them in some way or another? And sometimes that's going to be through the digital space. Sometimes that's going to be through word of mouth, which I sometimes feel is one of the most powerful ways that education and learning can be passed on, when one person has seen the amount of change it's made for their life. So they recommend it and pass it on. So I feel like my work is just beginning in terms of the achievement I feel in this book. But on a personal level, the work is still happening every day. Even right now, I'm feeling. This morning, I woke up with a little bit of kind of low level anxiety, that feeling of the pit in your stomach, or feeling like, oh, like something's not quite feeling right. And it is because I feel like I've got quite a few busy weeks ahead with the book coming out and a lot of kind of pressure that I'm putting on myself. And no one else is putting this pressure on me. I know I can be my own worst enemy sometimes, because because of the work that I do, and I just want to do it justice, right? So I do put a lot of pressure on myself to make sure I am doing this work justice. So I can be my own worst enemy and I can be really hard on myself. So I was just thinking about all the things I want to try and get done in the next couple of weeks. And it was kind of building up all these thoughts. And I think hand in hand with my issue with anxiety is also an issue of overthinking. And I realize I'm not alone in this. I've been reading a really great book at the moment. It's by Susan Mollen Hoeksema. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, so forgive me if I pronounce it incorrectly, but she has written a book called Women Who Think Too Much, How to Break Free of Overthinking and Reclaim Your Life. And I realized that one of my issues with anxiety and one of the reasons why I have these moments of panic or fear is because I do think too much. I'm an overthinker. And I think sometimes, I don't know if it's just who I am as a writer, as an academic, who I am as a person, I do think too much. So my thoughts will start in one place and 10 minutes later, my brain is all the way somewhere else. I'm like, how the hell did I get here? And I'm like, so exhausted by it and sometimes feeling anxious by it. So this book's really kind of supporting me in understanding how not to overthink and to recognize when I'm overthinking. And I still go to therapy. So I still go to therapy every 2-3 weeks. I've got a really great therapist. She is a South Asian woman, so she definitely gets some of the kind of cultural sensitivity. But she's also a neurobiologist as well as being a psychologist. So she really understands the workings of the brain and how sometimes our brains and our thoughts and our synapses and all the kind of the kind of neurological side of things, how to develop some of those things up in our own brains and our own minds. So it's an ongoing process. I make sure I'm taking time to still learn about my mental health. How can I improve my mental health? Keep that therapy going. I recommend therapy to everybody. If you can access therapy for free, or if you're in a fortunate position where you can financially afford it, then definitely get a therapist. I think it's one of the best things you can do for yourself.
Now that you're doing so many interviews, you're on TV, on media, on the radio, getting this book out, I wanted to ask you, how do you encourage yourself even more? I mean, this anxiety is there, or maybe this is not good enough, you overthink, but surely there has to be some part of you that says, actually, you know what, just breathe, you go, girl. You're doing really well done. And I know it's difficult to do that, because I say this because when I did my protest and I came on TV and Vogue and everything else that happened, everything that came along with it, for me, I was very fortunate that we were in that vacuum of the pandemic, that everything just rolled on. But also at the same time, everything happened so quickly. You know, things just sort of blew up overnight. And there I was on BBC and on on people's big screens talking about the pandemic. And I didn't have a chance to just sort of mentally catch up with it all. There was like a big gap between where people saw me and where I was mentally. So every time I'd go on TV, I'd get a call. I remember when I would get messages on Twitter all the time saying, hey, would you like to come on the radio tomorrow morning? Would you like to come on TV? And sometimes a part of me just wish I hadn't opened that message, because I didn't feel like I deserved to be in that position. And there was a voice in my head saying, Meenal, you're not good enough. Like, who do you think you are? You're just a doctor. You're not an expert on anything. You know, there was some part of me that's just saying, you're just a piece of shit, really. Like, who do you think you are doing all of this? And it's still there. Don't get me wrong. I haven't like overcome it completely, but I'm learning that process and that journey of not just about loving yourself. Cause I feel like loving yourself is a term that's just thrown on the internet. Like, love your body, love who you are. And it has to, you know, it has to be very unique to you. Like, love your ideas, love your thoughts, love your body, love how far you've come. So to get to that stage is taking me a lot of time. And I do feel that as much as it is a personal responsibility, it's also the responsibility of the people around you. And this is why I say, you know, I speak to my husband about how I feel, and he's been my biggest support. And he says, Meenal, actually, you're okay. You know, this podcast is really good, or this episode is really good. This year, you're doing okay. And sometimes you need to reach out to people. So how have you been taking care of yourself, and what's your ideas and thoughts on self-love and loving yourself? Because I feel that term is thrown around so much, it actually angers me sometimes, because people are like, love yourself. I'm like, how? Tell me how.
The self-love movement, which I talk about a lot as well. I've written poetry on self-love. I've been on campaigns that are supporting self-love. But you're absolutely right. It's, if you're looking at this, especially when you're coming from a place of you have got some insecurities about yourself, or there is a lot that you're working on, you're like, well, where is the self-love going to come from? It's not just going to wake up tomorrow and something that you automatically feel. And it's not a switch either. It's not an on-off button that one day you have self-love and the next day you'll have all of it and it'll stay there forever. There'll be days where the self-love dips. In the book, in terms of specifically self-love, I've spoken about setting a foundation of self-love. And what I've meant by that is kind of, I've spoken about kind of the foundation for a house, or when you have a foundation for a building. If you do not have this foundation of strong self-love, then anything that you build on top of it, professionally or personally, the job that you decide to go and do, the relationships that you go and have, if that foundation isn't strong, then anything that you build upon it will end up being a bit rocky, a bit unstable. So how do we set that strong foundation of self-love? Especially for Asian women, brown women like ourselves, who were never told how to set this strong foundation of self-love. For many of us, the moment that we were born, people wanted us to be a boy. From the moment we grow up, we are told to grow inwards, be quieter, be less out there, be less confident, don't be too mouthy, don't do this, don't do that. And for so long, Asian women are made to feel smaller and smaller and smaller. How do we build this self-love? So it's about figuring out for you as an individual, what are these things that are going to develop this sense of self-love? And in the book, I've given kind of lots of different pieces of advice and speaking to many other Asian women about what they've done over the years to find this sense of self-love. One of the things I've mentioned, these thoughts and feelings, but also writing down things that you are grateful for, your accomplishments, how far you've come. Because if you look at who you were a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, there's been so much development in that time and so much growth in that time. But have you really taken a moment to take stock of that before you move on to think about what you want to achieve next and what you want to do next? And I think it's partially to do with this culture that we're living in. So often when I'm doing these interviews these days, and it's a popular question that I'm happy to answer, but it's always about, okay, so what are you doing next? What are you working on next? What's next for Jaspreet? And it's a great question. And sometimes I share some of the thoughts I've got for what I want to do next. Do we ever say, well, I'm content with where I'm at right now, or maybe I'm already right where I want to be? I don't think we live in a culture where that's accepted. And I think sometimes we just need to recenter ourselves and say, okay, you know, where I'm at right now is amazing. And maybe this is where I'm right where I'm meant to be. And finding a sense of contentment in who you are right now And I lean into the Sikh faith a lot when it comes to these things about the concept of kind of Jag Di Kala, about eternal optimism. Because in moments and moments where you aren't feeling secure in yourself, moments where you are, and there's going to be that continuous kind of roller coaster throughout life. But how do you find this sense of kind of continuous contentment and continuous kind of calm and roller coaster is going on? So you've got to find those tools. You've got to find those methods, those tools that help you find that sense of contentment throughout. And meditation is also a really big one. I've spoken about journaling, I've spoken about writing, working out, speaking to people. But meditation is something within South Asian cultures that goes back for thousands of years. And I have a slight problem that is sometimes repackaged and resold back to us. The things that comes with globalization, and one of the things that happens with things that do work is that it may come back to us in different forms, a part of who we are for a very, very long time, whether that's in the Sikh faith, the Islamic faith, Buddhism, Hinduism. It's a big part of each of these faiths, of taking this moment to be still. And if it stood the test of time for that long, for thousands of years, back to the Vedic century, then is that not telling us something, that there's something here in meditation and mindfulness that can help us find a sense of contentment and peace? And since I've started regularly doing kind of mindfulness meditation every day, just starting off with 5 minutes a day, building that up to 10 minutes a day, I feel like that's where a lot of my self-love has really been growing, in those moments of meditation, because they do get me to be still. They get me to be grateful for where I'm at right now, and be a little bit self-reflective before you get back into that feeling of the rat race of what society is like, and then it's go, 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 go. So meditation, lean into that, lean into these old traditions, because if they've stood the test of time for that long, there's definitely some sense of power in them.
I think what you said was so true about what's next. Everybody wants to see, what is this tweet going to do next? What's this Instagram influencer going to do next? And we're chasing the numbers, we're chasing the views. And I hit a point a few months ago where I was offered a role, and on paper, it looked perfect for my age, for my, you know, for my specific point in my life. It would have been great. Like, it's something I probably would have dreamed of as a child. Like, this is everything I ever wanted. Mm-hmm. And then I took a step back and I thought, well, maybe right now is not the right time for me. And it was very difficult for me to even say that out loud and even write that on paper, because the specific role that I was offered, I thought, well, maybe I can do a better job of it in 10 years' time. And perhaps it's not fair on me or on my family to put myself under this pressure to go into something that I don't know much about. But on paper, it sounds great. On a newspaper article, on a headline, it would sound perfect. But I decided not to do that. And it was a big step to speak, because it made me realize that perhaps most of the decisions we take, we're looking at the lens of, what will other people think? How will it look on the outside? If I get this new role, if I get this new job, if I get this new position, how does it look on the outside? What would people perceive me as? We forget to think, actually, what impact does it have on a personal level? And I think this idea of Instagram, Twitter, and social media, it's one of those things. I really feel that there's going to hit a point in our generation where nobody will use it anymore. I think we're really just going to get fed up.
I cannot wait for that day.
We're going to hit these platforms now.
Wait for that day. Don't get me wrong, I have this love-hate relationship with social media, and it's something I've outlined in the book, that it can be an incredible space, especially for South Asian women, and as a way to navigate our identity, a place for self-education. Sometimes for a lot of women, they've not seen a lot of this knowledge or education in other places, so they found it in the digital space. Obviously a sense of solidarity with others that might be passionate about the same issues as you, a sense of sisterhood. There's wonderful things that come out of it that haven't happened in any other time in human history. It's been really significant in moments of activism, in moments of protest. I do hope there's a day where these social media platforms collapse and they no longer exist, because I want all of this moving into the real world too. I want it moving into community spaces. I want it happening in the real world. And I do wish that we come back to being present in the real world, because that's the problem with social media. We've got this thing glued to our phone that we see all the time that's telling us to be a certain way or learn a certain thing or become a certain thing, or this very kind of competitive nature on social media that is so toxic. And you've mentioned it about growing followers, doing this, getting onto the next thing, getting onto the next thing. Then there's a new thing that goes viral, or there's a new thing that you have to do to improve your engagement, or there's a new algorithm. And if we look at all these social media companies and the premise of why they started, it was never for our liberation. It was never for us to develop self-love. It was never going to be saving us. These apps were not built to save us. So that's something I've recognized. And yeah, I hope there's a day we're no longer on it and they all just disappear.
Well, perhaps just like we had the whole world in lockdown during the pandemic, which was nobody predicted, and it sort of hit a big reset button on society. Perhaps that might just happen to the internet. Like, you know, I do think that when Radhika grows up, I think she might just look back and say, "Mom, were you really on all these apps, like writing tweets and posting photos of yourself to gain followers?" And stuff. I think it sounds crazy when you look at it from the outside.
It sounds crazy when you say it like that.
Yeah, when I say it out loud, it sounds quite absurd, doesn't it? Just breathe. I'm going to think twice now before tweeting the next thing. But you're right. I think that we all need a reset. And I do agree that it needs to be moved into community spaces. I'll be very honest. I wish the openness I had on Instagram, I wish I could be just as open with my own family. You know, it's crazy how on Instagram I'll share stuff that I might not even share with my family. Yeah, they might see it and stuff, but it's become a safe space, quite possibly because there are no real life consequences. You post something and it happens and that's it, and you keep your mouth shut. But we're more afraid to do it in our own families and our own spaces because there might be consequences from it. But I think when that day happens, just breathe. I'll be very happy as well. And hopefully we can sort of move into being more human, I guess. Before I go, just breathe. I mean, I've said this, I love everything you do. I love your book. I love how it's a guide to different parts of our society and different parts of our life. And I can go back to any chapter at any point in my life and remind myself, oh, these are the things I need to put in place. These are the things I need to do. And I think I sent you a message saying that when Radhika grows up, it's going to be like our go-to book. Every time Radhika has a bad day, we're going to say, okay, what did Auntie Jaspreet say? What did she say about this? How can we go back and how can we talk about these things? Because we never had that growing up. And it goes through my head on a daily basis. How can I make things not just different, but much better for Radhika and make her achieve her potential in a way that we've never been able to do? How are you feeling about everything? Your book is about to come out to the world. People are ordering it. People are, you know, pre-ordering it. You're doing lots of interviews. You're getting out there. How have you prepared for the next few weeks? Because obviously once it all happens after the 17th of February, it's done. And you don't want it to just you don't want it to just sort of pop like a balloon and then just deflate. And you're going to have a lot of time to reflect. You're going to have a lot of time to think about things. How have you mentally prepared yourself for the next month or so?
A really good question. Really good question. There's lots happening in the next couple months about, okay, a lot of publicity around the book, of course, kind of going across the country, if possible, speaking to as many people as possible and making sure I'm trying to reach as many people as possible. But in terms of on a personal level, things that I'm going to have to think about for myself is that when this book now reaches people's hands, there's going to be a whole wave of different emotions that might be coming my way, positive, negative, and everything in between. And that energy transfer is something I've learned a lot over the last couple of years as a public speaker, as a performer, as a poet. There is this transfer of energy that happens when I do this work. It is me giving out a lot of energy, which can be exhausting. It can be tiring physically and mentally. And there are times where I've had this burnout and I've recognized because I'm filling out or taking out a lot of my energy and not necessarily filling myself back up. and then the transfer of energy back from people. And there'll be positive things. There'll be things people who do read the book saying that they have related to it, resonated, hopefully found a sense of healing. But there may be people who say, I don't get it, it wasn't for me, or have certain dislikes about the book. And that's totally valid and that's totally fine. I don't expect it to really work for every single person. If anything, that should be motivation for them to go write something that will work for them personally. So if I receive any of that negative energy, I'm just going to be giving out vibes of that's okay, that's still valid, as long as it's not mean and abusive, because those people can just, you know, get out of here. But if it's coming from a place of constructive criticism, my advice is go do the work that you feel needs to be done then, if you don't necessarily agree in the way that I've done it. Hopefully that motivates people to get on and write your own book. Get on and do more of the work if you feel there's still more that needs to be done. I feel that's how you have progress. If we were all agreeing with each other all the time and all saying yes, 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 then how do we progress as a society? I feel like you need a little bit of that. Constructive criticism, not people being mean and horrible. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of that happening in the next couple months, positive, negative, all that sort of stuff. I'm going to have to make sure I'm conscious of filling up my energy, taking time for pausing, taking time to reflect. It's been a very exhausting few years of writing the book, and then the whole publicity and marketing of the book has been even more exhausting. I think I've found this bit a little bit harder, if anything. Going back to like sitting at my desk and writing is my safe place, kind of being in that writing mode and being my little hermit self. And as you know, I came off social media during that time when I was writing the book because I wanted to go into that period of deep work and not be distracted by social media. So if anything, I'm finding this time a bit harder. So I'm hoping after kind of this initial push through the spring and early summer, over the summer, I do want to just take some downtime and just take time to breathe and process everything that's happened over the last 2-3 years. Not only the book, but also surviving a worldwide pandemic and just taking some moment to rest and find some joy and really fill myself back up again before I decide to get on and fight the next mission.
That's great. I think it's so important to plan our rests as well and our breaks. We plan so much of our life, our meetings, our calls, our next projects. We take little time to plan our rest periods. And I think it's so important to do that as well. Jaspreet, thank you so much for joining me. This was such a lovely conversation. I really feel we could just, you know, just sit here for hours and just chat.
Hours. Yeah, I know.
I didn't even send you a message before saying this is what we're going to talk about, because I was like, you know what, there's no point. I mean, Jaspreet and I, we're always chatting, we're always talking about stuff, and I just wanted this to be as natural as possible and just talk about as much as we could in the time we had. So before we go, Jaspreet, how can people order your book?
Oh, yes. If you would like to order Brown Girl Like Me, it's available at all good bookstores. So Waterstone, WH Smith's, it's also available on Amazon. The easiest place to find that all is if you go to www.browngirllikeme.com. You'll find all the places that the book is available. And obviously you can find me online at Behind the Nebra. But we've also recently just launched the Brown Girl Like Me page as well, which is going to be showing more specific stuff from the book and highlights from the book. So yeah, that's where you can find everything about the book and about what I'm up to too.
Thank you, Jaspreet. I hope you have a very exciting few weeks, but I also hope that you have the time to take care of yourself, because it can be very exhausting, it can be very tiring. So I'm very excited to see what the next few weeks hold for you, but not just that, just the future, Jaspreet. I know there's so much more to come from you. I'm not putting any pressure on you. I'm just saying, just in general, there's a lot more to come from you, and I really
have a lot more to give.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, Jaspreet. Thank you so much. Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in, and thank you, Jaspreet, for joining me for a second time on this podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to Jaspreet's process and just learning a little bit more about her as an author. You can follow all of her work at Behind the Netra, and as I said, everything is in the show notes. You can pre-order her book on her website, browngirllikeme.com. Please do let me know if there are any guests you'd like to hear from on this podcast, if there's anybody in particular that you'd like me to interview. I'm on most social media handles, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all under at Dr. Meenal Viz. Thank you for tuning in again this week, and I can't wait to record another episode and bring you another exciting guest next week.